So as the terrific staff here at the Ritz is clearing the tables, we thought we'd get the main event of the speakers underway, just again so we can keep you on that timeline that I set out earlier on. And so my job now is to introduce both Robin Gullison, and then I'll be back to introduce Stu Kedwell. So starting with Robin, I really shouldn't have to look at my notes, but he's worked with us at the Harbor Group since 2011, and he brings with him a decade and a half of investment experience, most of which with RBC. Prior to working with the Harbor Group, Robin was the individual who ran the fixed income desk at RBC, and so his clients were the 1,600 investment advisors spread out across the country, where he originated all the investment advice as it relates to fixed income products, and that's bonds and GICs and preferred shares and these sorts of things. And we made him an offer, and he decided that he'd accept and get a little bit closer to the client, and it's been an absolute fantastic partnership ever since. So Robin is now going to walk us through the big picture. You know, where do we see the economy? What's happening both in Canada and the U.S.? We'll touch on the currency, I believe, which is a timely topic. And then I'll be back to introduce Stu Kedwell. So, Robin, over to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Chris, and thank everybody for joining us today. I started off with a little cartoon here, just a deep look at what happens inside the bowels of the RBC Economics Department. See, there's a lot of screens there, but the most important tool is the coin. I guess the crystal ball is broken. So a little more seriously, we're going to focus on four main themes today. And the four themes I'm going to focus today are, number one, on the U.S. economy. We think the U.S. economy continues to be on track, and we're very likely to see the Federal Reserve raise interest rates for the first time in many years later on this year. The Canadian economy is a bit challenged, but we think a lot of the bad news is priced into the currency, into our interest rates, into our stock market. Number three, we think the equity market's at reasonable valuations, particularly versus a lot of the alternatives in the fixed income market. There's some pockets of excess happening in mergers and acquisitions and private technology valuations, but we think public equities are actually fairly valued here. And lastly, I'll talk a little bit about volatility. We're 6 years into this current bull market, and typically as you see bull markets age, volatility picks up, but what's most important is that the economy keeps growing and we don't have a recession in the United States. So first theme, looking at the U.S., one of the big things we're looking at the U.S. is the fact this has been a weak cycle. So this isn't really new news. Typically after a recession, the U.S. economy grows at 3, 4% or more. We've grown in kind of a 2 to 3% range, and while that's a bit disappointing as far as it relates to total economic growth, low but positive growth and low inflation and low interest rates have actually been really positive for the stock market. And you can see here, we've got a chart showing all the economic cycles going back to the Second World War. So each one of these lines represents the cumulative growth in the U.S. economy. And you can see the bottom line is the current cycle. So even though the length is about the average length of the typical economic cycle, the growth is actually near the lower end. And because it's been a weak cycle, we think it'll probably be a longer cycle. So what typically happens is once you get strong economic growth, you start to see interest rates increase, and you start to see the Federal Reserve start to raise interest rates to put pressure on the economy. Eventually, you get a recession out of that. Well, right now, there's not really a lot of excesses. We have very low inflation. We have wage growth that's just starting to pick up. And we have interest rates that are just about to come off of zero. So the way we look at it, we don't see a U.S. recession on the horizon for the next 12 months, and that's about as far out as people forecast. And as long as you don't have that happening, you've got a fairly good setup for equity returns. So one of the big themes this year, of course, has been the decline in oil prices and the decline in fuel prices. And many people, including myself, thought that would be a boost to consumer spending. We haven't really seen that come through in the data yet, but the historical evidence is it takes about a year to 18 months for fuel prices to feed through. So if you think about where we were in January of last year, we were supposed to be back at $75 or $80 oil by now, right? And, of course, we're at about $42 when I walked out of the office to come here. So the way we look at it, when you first get this big shock, it helps consumer spending because you do have extra money in your pocket, but it doesn't necessarily get spent right away because people think it's temporary. And one of the funnier indicators we've seen is the chart here on page 7. This is the change in tobacco shipments in the United States. And you can see that this year, tobacco shipments are up for the first time since 2007. And the research I was reading behind this is because of lower gas prices. So I guess if you think of a typical consumer going to fill up their tank with cash, the $60 fill-up turns into $50, and you've got extra money in your pocket, so you buy whatever it might be, cigarettes, pop, whatever you might buy at the convenience store. Our view is that once these savings have been around for a year or longer, it's probably seen as more permanent and work more into people's budgets, and you start to see it show through in the rest of the economy. And I don't have the chart up here because it's a pretty complicated chart, but the history is that about 18 months after a big drop in fuel prices, you see the economy start to pick up in the U.S. Shifting gears to Canada, we think Canadian stocks are in the bargain bin as foreigners take a dim view of our economy. So again, it's no secret that growth in Canada has been weak. We've had a lot of foreign investors maybe avoiding our market, some maybe even betting against it. So one popular trade for some hedge funds has been to try and bet against the Canadian banks. It always seems like they're doing it right before the banks report earnings. The earnings come through fine. They have to cover their shorts, and the bank stocks rally. We've seen that happen many, many times. So we think that there is definitely a dim view towards Canada on the foreign stage. But we think, you know, it's not new news that the Canadian economy has been weak, but how much is priced in? So this chart is from RBC Asset Management, and it simply shows the relative performance of the TSX compared to the S&P 500 in the U.S., taking into account the currency. And you can see here on the right-hand side of the chart, you had a big outperformance for Canada from the late 90s to the mid-2000s, and since then that's really come unglued. And you can see we're almost at the lows on a relative basis versus the U.S. market you saw back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So this doesn't necessarily mean it's over yet and that Canada's due to outperform the U.S., but we'd argue that a lot of bad news is already priced into the Canadian stock market, particularly versus the U.S. Looking at our banks, again, if you look at banks on a price-to-book ratio, the banks are almost as cheap as they've been since the financial crisis. Right now, the banks traded about 1.6 times their book value. So that's the value of all their assets less their liabilities, essentially. Typically, the banks traded about 2 times their book value. They've been as low as 1.3 during the financial crisis. The current valuation is the same you saw during the telco cable blow-up in the early 2000s and about the same as during the Asian crisis. So again, we don't think the banks are going to have superior growth from here forward, right? The Canadian consumer is largely tapped out. You're probably going to start seeing losses pick up at some point in the cycle, but we argue that a lot of that bad news is already priced into the Canadian bank stocks. So looking at the Canadian economy, we've already seen a lot of bad news, but we are seeing things start to turn around a bit. After 6 months of negative growth in Canadian GDP, you've seen it start to pick up in the last 3 months. It's turned positive as you've got the weaker Canadian dollar start to feed through and the shock from the oil crisis starting to wear off a bit. And that's also starting to show itself in exports. So that's one of the things you'd expect to see, right? We've had a 30% depreciation in the Canadian dollar. Typically, you should see exports start to pick up. It took a while. It didn't happen until June, July this year. But now we're seeing exports start to turn higher. So it doesn't mean Canada's completely out of the woods, but the things you should be seeing after a big drop in commodity prices and big drop in currency are starting to happen. So we're optimistic that we've seen the worst for the Canadian economy. Theme number three, looking at equity valuations. This next chart on page 14, I think, is the most important to take home today. If there's one chart you want to remember, I think it's this one. And this is simply shows the TSX in dark blue going back to 2010. And the gold line is the dividend yields of the TSX, and that's indexed on the right-hand side. You can see here the Canadian markets had a tough time, particularly on an index level, because the commodity sectors have been under a significant amount of pressure. And you've got the TSX trading at a level it actually traded at back in 2011. But if you look at the dividend yield or look at the income that the portfolio would be throwing off if your portfolio was the TSX, it's actually up 32% since 2011. So in the last 4 years, the TSX's yield is 32% higher, even though the index is at the same level. So we talk a lot in our written commentaries and our conference calls about the power of dividend growth. I think this is one of the most clear ways to show it, that even though capital values have been volatile, particularly for Canadian stocks, the income has kept on coming through and has been growing, which we think is the most important in the long run, and it's going to be a big driver of return. So one of the things we always worry about is a U.S. recession, because history shows that a recession in the U.S., and in the U.S. in particular, is very challenging for stock markets. That's when you tend to get the really bad bear markets. You get corrections along the way, of course, during economic expansions, but the really bad bear markets come with a U.S. recession. So the next natural question is, well, how far ahead of a U.S. recession do we have to worry? Because the stock market, as we all know, is a discounting mechanism. It tends to discount what happens 6 to 12 months in advance. So this is in data from J.P. Morgan, and it shows how often or how far ahead of the economy the stock market peaks. And on average, that's about 8 months. That means 8 months before an official recession starts, you see the stock market peak. The longest time has been 13 months. The shortest has been 2 months. So we think, looking at this data, if we don't think there's going to be a recession in the U.S. in the next 12 months, we don't have to worry as much about a bear market. We're always worried about a bear market. We're always worried about corrections. We're always looking at all the latest economic data to see if there's any bad news lurking on the horizon. But the historical data shows, and this goes back to the mid-1950s, that on average, the market peaks about 8 months before the economy. So once we get indications that a recession is more likely in the next year, we'll start to get worried and probably get a little more defensive. But until that time comes, we're not going to worry as much about tilting the portfolios in a really defensive fashion. Last theme, team number four, talking a bit about volatility. We think the elevated level of volatility we've seen over the last 6 months is likely to persist, but probably not as sharp as we saw in August and September. I think what we had in the fall was a very typical correction. It didn't really feel typical when you're going through it, of course. Corrections never do. But the market since recovered quite handily from then, particularly in the U.S. And as long as the U.S. economy remains in expansion, we think the bull market is going to continue. So on page 17, this shows the median S&P 500 performance going into the first Fed rate hike. So I apologize, the lines are a bit thin on this, but the vertical line is the date of the first Fed rate hike. And the squiggly line is the average of all the cycles going back for Fed rate hikes. And as you can see here, typically going to that first Fed rate hike, you do see the market dip a little bit. You get a bit of a correction. And to us, that makes sense, especially this cycle. If you think about it, you've had U.S. rates at zero for over 7 years. You haven't had a rate hike out of the Fed in 9 years. So when you're going from zero to something that's not zero, that's going to change people's allocations and how they finance their businesses and their investments. And that's going to create some uncertainty. So it's not really surprising to see a correction going into the first rate hike. The thing we look at is what happens after. And typically, as long as the economy keeps growing, the market keeps going higher after. Our view on corrections has been that the probability that we're going to A, sell at the top, B, buy at the bottom, and C, give up dividend income and also potentially pay unnecessary capital gains tax is a very unlikely combination. Our view of corrections is, in order to be prepared for them, that you have a buy list ready of things you want to buy that are maybe at valuations that are too high now. Because our probability of selling at the top and buying at the bottom is probably not going to work out and will cause more stress than anything else. So talking more about volatility, as the economic cycle ages, you tend to see volatility pick up. And this is a really clean measure of volatility. It simply shows the number of days a year that the S&P 500 is up or down by more than 1%. Pardon me, the percentage of days. So you see on the far left-hand side, in the first year of a bull market, the market is up or down by 1% about 24% of the time. And that makes sense to me because in the first year of a bull market, number one, you don't even know you're in a bull market because you're coming out of a bear market. You might still be in recession. There's a lot of uncertainty. The data still looks really bad, but it's usually just getting less bad. And that's when the market starts to move. So it makes sense you have a lot of volatility there. And as you get into the cycle, the volatility dies down as people are more sure that you're in an economic expansion in a bull market. But as the bull market ages and you get to year 7, which is where we are now, volatility picks up again. It happens about 22% of the time. So about 1 in 5 days, you see the market up or down by more than 1%. And again, as the cycle ages, you start to get interest rates moving higher, people worrying about the Fed. It makes sense that the volatility picks up. And that's why we think, you know, you had 3 years in the U.S. where you didn't get a 10% correction. That was the anomaly. It's actually much more normal to have corrections every 12 to 18 months. As uncomfortable as they are, that's what the history looks like for the market. We like to focus on the long term, and over the long term, it's earnings growth and dividends that are going to drive returns. And this chart simply shows the contribution to return from changes in earnings and changes in the P.E. ratio. So the P.E. ratio is the price-earnings ratio, or how much people are willing to pay for $1 of earnings. And we look at that as basically sentiment. So if you think about a one-day period, on any given day, as I showed in the last slide, the market can be up or down by more than 1%. But how much do fundamentals for the whole market change on any given day? Almost zero on any given day. So over a one-day period, the change in the market is almost all sentiment. But if you look at the right-hand side of this slide, the dark blue takes up about 85% of that bar. So over 60 months or 5 years, 85% of returns are determined by changes in earnings. So that's what we like to focus on. Can we find companies that are going to have a sustainable competitive advantage, can grow their earnings, grow their dividends, and return money to shareholders through dividends and share buybacks? Because that's what tends to work over the longer term. The last slide I have for you is, you know, looking at a long, long chart of the S&P 500 in the U.S. This goes back to the Great Depression, and it shows secular, which is an investment term for long-term, cycles in the stock market. So typically you have about 16-year cycles where you have what they call a secular bear market, where on this chart it looks like the market's going sideways, but as we all know, when you're living through it, it doesn't feel like sideways. It's a lot of really nasty ups and downs. Then you tend to get 16 years where the trend is predominantly up. So if you look at where we are today, you had a secular bear market from 2000 till 2013, And in 2013, the S&P 500 actually broke out above the prior highs seen in 2000 and 2007. So if we have entered into a new secular bull market, it's a very positive thing, because during a secular bull market, you tend to have stronger upswings and weaker downswings, whereas when you're in a secular bear market, you tend to get much nastier drawdowns and the rallies aren't as strong. So there's big implications if you move into a secular bull market that the profile for returns is definitely more attractive. So the bottom line, in summary, number one, we think the U.S. economy will continue to grow and lead the world, and that should help Canada because we're the U.S.'s biggest trading partner. Number two, the Canadian economy has had a difficult year in 2015, but we think a lot of bad news is already priced into interest rates, the currency, and the market. Number three, we think equity markets are reasonably valued, particularly versus alternatives. And the last few years in Canada has really shown that dividend growth pays off, and it can really help to offset some of the volatility seen in capital values. Lastly, we think the correction in the summer was a very typical correction, even though it didn't feel like it at the time. And the big thing we watch, as long as the economy keeps growing, that should help the bull market to continue. Thank you very much. And Chris is going to come up. Okay.
So we're going to hold the questions until the end. And it's now my job to introduce Stu Kedwell, who started with the firm in 1996 in the generalist program, and I believe was identified as a rising star and rose up through the ranks, and at this point in time is one of the portfolio managers at RBC Global Asset Management, who is the co-portfolio manager on the RBC Dividend Fund, RBC North American Value Fund. I think I'm missing one fund in there. But essentially is advising and managing on in excess of $50 billion worth of assets. And so we've told Stu that he was allowed to have one slide. We figured there was enough in the previous slides, and so he is going to do his job with a single slide to reference through the whole piece. So, Stu, welcome.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate everyone coming for lunch today. The Harbor Group is always very kind to ask me to come each year, which I appreciate. They're an absolutely wonderful partner of ours and a great investment advisory team. So I know you're all in very good hands, and glad for that. So I only need one slide. I just have my one slide, North American Capital Markets Update, and the most important thing that I do is I'm a unit holder of the funds under our care. I think I have the best job in the whole world. I get to manage the RBC Canadian Dividend Fund, North American Value Fund, which I put my own money in, and figure out how they can compound over time for the benefit of myself and my family, which I think is the same thing that that all clients are trying to do. So hopefully we can have a discussion around what's available on that front. So, just to put some perspective on it, when I think about my my portfolio, the Canadian Dividend Fund is my RRSP. I think about dividend fund stocks or dividend stocks, which would likely look very similar to the portfolios that you might have, as that picture came up of the current yield of the TSX being in the neighborhood of 3.5%. And the way that I think about dividend stocks is like this over time. So if I can have a portfolio of common stocks, good common stocks, and they yield 3% and 4%, and they grow those dividends between 4% and 7% over time, then between the two, the 3.5% of current yield, the dividend growth, I'm going to compound my money at high single digits over long periods of time. And the other fund I have, which is a larger equity holding, is the North American Value Fund, and it's 50% in the United States and 50% in Canada. And I think those discussions are very similar to what you may have when it comes to the equity in your portfolio as well. And again, I think that the equity markets are designed and likely priced to some degree to help compound capital in the 7% to 9% range over time. So, there's kind of four things I think that we need to take into consideration when we think about the environment that we have today. The first is investor personalities and behaviors that we see in the marketplace. I'll get home and my wife will have CP24 on, or my kids will have listened to something on the radio, and they say, what happens in the stock market each day? Up, down, up, down. This doesn't seem to make too much sense. And, so I think we have to be very aware of the personalities. Like, you know, Robin mentioned that as we get more years into an economic cycle, volatility does pick up. But even taking a step back, you know, let's think about a lot of us still are afraid by the financial crisis. And the behavior that, that comes from that is when the stock market starts to go down, there's an immediate belief that this is about to be a real doozy and a big one. And, I want to adjust my behavior very quickly for that. And we see that, you know, movement in the stock market, very significant volatility. And, you know, that's in our minds a very much a function of behavior and investor personality. You can go and you can measure sentiment in the stock market. You can say, you can do a survey of people each week and you say, are you bullish or are you bearish? And each week people answer that survey and you mark it on a chart. And in the past, that number would fluctuate around, but never really like too significantly. Yet in the last 6 months when we run that type of survey, we see massive swings in the sentiment, you know, to the point where in the bottom of the correction in early September, October, that sentiment was as negative as it was right in the midst of the financial crisis. And the good thing or the interesting thing about sentiment is that as the market responds or the market bounces back, you get a rise in sentiment. You know, so we have to pay, you know, very careful attention to this. Like probably, you know, for the next little while, the best time to be putting money into the stock market is when it feels the worst to do that, right? So that's kind of like Warren Buffett's, you know, buy fear and sell cheer, right? That's, you know, that's kind of the notion that we're in right now. So, you know, the sentiment rocketing around, unfortunately, is likely, you know, par for the course. The money management industry, particularly in the United States, has responded to this behavior, this change in investor behavior, with products that are entitled Go Anywhere funds. So there's as much as $400 billion in the United States has gone into these funds. And when you go into one of these funds, these people, you know, attempt to get every day of the stock market correct. You know, so if you added up all the point movements in the S&P 500 between kind of the middle of August and the end of October, there was, you know, so the S&P 500 is 2,000, give or take. That's the level of the index. And if you added up all the movements in those days, like legitimate movements, not day, not minute by minute, but hour by hour, we moved 1,000 points. So if you got every movement correct, you'd have made 50% in those 3 months. And if you got every movement incorrect, you'd have lost 50% in those 3 months. And that, you know, that's kind of symbolic of this money that's out there. You know, as I say, particularly in the United States, this hasn't been a big Canadian trend, but the money is just trying to get every day in and out. And we see it on our trading desk, and I'm sure, you know, the members of the Harbor Group see it the same way. It's this kind of, you know, kind of big movement of money in and out, kind of like tide coming in and out. And the last thing is that the tools that are available for this type of movement in the market are also, you know, they've kind of gone ballistic. So whether or not it's exchange-traded funds, you know, technology that allows the rapid movement in and out of the marketplace, this is also at a very elevated level. So when you kind of marry all that together, you have sensitive behavior, a bunch of products that are designed to try and get every day correct, and tools to do so that have never really have been available before. And as a result, we get a very volatile environment. And that's, unfortunately, that's likely to persist. But, you know, we can try and have our, you know, have our heads about us and think about some of the things that are going on. I'm not going to spend, you know, too much time on the economy. But, you know, what I thought I would do is as I, you know, build my own financial plan and you build your financial plans, there's kind of three things that really stick out for an investor when they sit down to think about, you know, how their investment should look. You know, the first is you want to have a general background of what you think the economy is doing. And, you know, Robin mentioned that the economy is in okay shape. You know, probably the two things that we worry about or think about in terms of what would take, you know, economic momentum away, it's tighter money. So things, you know, money not as free flowing, interest rates start to rise, maybe that takes some liquidity away. You know, we're not, you know, we might get one or two movements from the Federal Reserve, but we're a long way from tighter money. And the second thing is the slope of the yield curve, which when you look at a 10-year bond minus a very short-term bond, when that's positive, the odds of the economy going into recession are very low, and it's quite positively shaped right now. So, you know, the economy is kind of slow, not firing in all cylinders, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, kind of making progress. Employment's pretty good. The consumer in the United States has to be feeling better. And, you know, the backdrop is, I would say, okay. When we start thinking about the stock market, the most important thing that comes from the economy in our minds is when we sit down with management teams. So, you know, what would really concern you is if you had a slow growth economic environment, but a bunch of management teams that were developing their business plan for a very fast growing economy. Because you would have a disjoint. You'd say, well, you know, you're going to build all these things and the economy might not come through and get you a good return on your investment. What we have today is significant unanimity between what management teams are doing to their business and what we see in the economy. So that's pretty important when it comes to the broader setup of the stock market. Like, you know, I like to say, you know, I always kind of judge the cycles by, you know, the amount of stationery that we have on our office floor, right? Like, you know, when I go to the stationery drawer and it's locked and I have to make a case to get a pencil out of it, you know, then I know that, you know, that management has tightened the screws. They're preparing for a slower growth environment. And, you know, other times I go and it's a bonanza, right? I can bring my kids in. We can take highlighters. We can take whatever we want. You know, so right now we have this environment where management and the economy, they're on the same page, right? They have the same set of fears that we have as investors. They're sitting there going, you know, boy, it's slow. I don't really want to make that investment. You know, to some degree that's holding back the economy, but it also raises the odds as an investor that big capital investments that aren't going to go anywhere are not too likely. So, you know, the first thing we do is we sit and we got our investor personalities, and we know that that's going to be more volatile going forward, but we try and develop tools to help us deal with that, you know, kind of keep it in the back of our head, buy fear, sell cheer, so we kind of have that division going. Then we think about the economy, slow growth, but not too bad. And then we think about the earnings that the stock market is generating. So, you know, we think about the TSX or the S&P 500 as one big machine, right? So if it's the S&P 500, I have my Microsoft division, I have my General Electric division, I have my Johnson & Johnson division. All these companies are inside the S&P 500, and they generate earnings. So the S&P is around 2,000. So if it was one company, it trades for $2,000. It generates around $125 of earnings. So it's trading a little bit over 16 times earnings right now, or right around 16 times earnings. It has $40 of dividends. So it's not as high as it is in Canada, but still a 2% dividend yield. And you know, we think a lot about these earnings. Like you know, Warren Buffett is, you know, I'm going to borrow from Warren Buffett quite a bit, but you know, he has this great notion of really focusing on how much earnings are coming from the machine at a given point in time. And as a long-term investor, if I think I have my behavior established and I think I have a broad understanding of the economy, what I'm most fearful when I make an investment is the earnings elevated? Is it too elevated relative to history? Is it kind of in line with history, or is it depressed? And if it's depressed, that's almost always a fantastic time to buy stocks because that depressed level of earnings will recover. So, you know, right now we kind of, the way we think about that is we can measure the return on equity of our big machine, right? So our big S&P 500, our big company in the United States, its return on equity goes up and down over time. When that machine is firing on all cylinders, it has a 20% return on equity, a 20% return on equity. And when the return on equity is 20, we want to be careful because it doesn't sustain itself there. Right? Normally when it's 20, that's like saying, boy, everyone's very excited about things. Bad decisions get made. We have to be somewhat careful about the earnings coming from our machine. In recessions, that ROE often drops to 7 or 8%, sometimes lower, 6, 7, 8%. During those periods of time, that's when you want to be, you know, very excited because recessions eventually come to end. You know, as Warren Buffett would say, every storm runs out of rain. And, you know, and that's a very significant time to be buying stocks. Where do we sit today on that earnings front? The return on equity is right in the range of normal. It's right around 13 or 14%. So the earnings coming from our machine are quite doable over long periods of time. And that's a very important answer for a long-term investor. The earnings coming from our machine are right within the range of normal. And if I can, as an investor, if I can buy normal earnings, those should grow over time in line with long-term averages, which is around 6 or 7%. So if the machine is running, you know, kind of at normal, that's not a bad time for a long-term investor. You know, it'll fluctuate around, but still, you know, very much within the range of normal. So our earnings, you know, they're kind of in the range of normal. And the last thing on our checklist is the multiple that we pay for those earnings. The multiple that we pay for those earnings. And right now, you know, with the S&P 500 around, you know, I think this morning it was 2070 or 2060. we're divide that by the $125 of earnings that's coming, and we're around, 16 and a half times earnings. And that is slightly high. That is slightly high. 2 months ago, we traded at 14.7 times earnings. That's quite good, relatively speaking, for what we see. So, we have this brash movement in the stock market, we know our earnings, they're in line with normal. It's the multiple that we pay for those earnings that really ricochets around. So when we think about the multiple over time, what do we think about? Interest rates. That's the first thing. Most important to the multiple is interest rates. Second most important is inflation. In a low interest rate environment, in a low inflation environment, stocks can trade at high multiples, higher than average multiples. So, to us, 15 is very reasonable within the context of low interest rates and low inflation. Some would argue it could be higher, which is possible, but 15, very, very reasonable to us. And the reason for that is when you sit and think about, take a company like Microsoft, right? So just for sake of argument, Microsoft trades around 15 or 16 times earnings. And think about that very first dollar that comes out of Microsoft, the very first dollar of earnings. Like, how stable is that first dollar of earnings? What would you rather have, a dollar from the U.S. government or the very first dollar of earnings from Microsoft, right? I'd say, well, boy, that dollar from Microsoft is pretty good, the very first dollar. In the stock market, that dollar from Microsoft trades at 15 times, and a dollar from the U.S. government trades at 50 times. That's the spread that exists in the stock market today. If I walk in and I buy a $100 bond, I get $2 back a year, and I get $100 in 10 years. I get no growth, I get my $2 back, I pay 50 times, 100 divided by 2, for the earnings that come from a bond. In the stock market, the first dollar of earnings from Microsoft trades at 15 or 16 times, and unfortunately so does the last dollar. And the last dollar causes all the consternation because it is more volatile than the U.S. government. But the first dollar is pretty good. So when we sit and think about the spread, would I be willing to say 15 or 16 times for a company like Microsoft against 50 in the U.S. government? And I'll say I'll take some volatility in these earnings, but I get growth over time. So I think I'll take that. I think that spread is very wide. And that's kind of what we have in the stock market right now. And that's augmented when inflation is very low because the value of the business is protected. It doesn't get eaten away by higher inflation. So when we sit and think about that multiple, and we think about where interest rates are, and we think about where, good earnings trade in the stock market, that gap seems extremely wide to us. If I paid 15 times earnings for the stock market, the earnings compounded at 7%, I received 2% from my dividend, that's 9. That's quite a bit better than 2 from a bond. That's kind of like the ideal situation as the market moves around. That's very interesting to us. Then we try and stress test that case, right? Because people say, well, there's a lot of concerns out there. What if the economy is even worse? It's like, okay, well, let's assume that the normal earnings that come from our machine, they don't take place. It's going to be 10, 12, 15% lower on earnings. Even though all the times in the past where the ROE has dipped, management has found new ways to get those earnings back to normal. But let's assume that takes place, and let's assume that earnings only grow at 5 instead of 7, and that our multiple doesn't stay at 15. It only goes to 12 or 13. What does that 10-year picture look like for stocks? That looks like about 5% on the stock market. Still twice what's available in fixed income. And the times that we get very worried about the equity market is when our bearish scenario is very close to fixed income. That's when we start to raise more alarm bells. So it's not to say that stocks aren't going to be volatile, but when we think about long-term investment, and we sit and think, like, what is a long-term investor really worried about? They worry about the earnings coming from the machine and the multiple that I pay for them. Those are still within the realm of not bad when it comes to the potential returns in your portfolio. So that's the way that we are thinking about the stock market. When it comes to the TSX, has been, a significantly poorer performer than the S&P 500. The earnings that are coming from the TSX machine are around $900 for next year. So the TSX at 13,000 or whatever around that neighborhood, it trades for slightly less than the S&P 500, but the earnings are more dependent on things like energy and a few other sectors going forward. So We do think that there's some interest. You know, the bank chart went up on the multiples that are in the banking sector, and you know, we look at the current yields of banks and the likelihood of dividend growth, and that more than satisfies the longer term equation inside of the inside of a dividend portfolio. But probably the biggest area of potential you know, skew to the upside would be the energy sector, which has been pummeled as crude has fallen down into the low $40 per barrel level. That's worthy of some discussion. We think, you know, the ingredients for crude's recovery are falling into place. The cure to low prices is low prices. The question is, when does that take place? And at the same time, there is, you know, more to the debate versus prior cycles, because there's a lot of concerns over carbon. There's a lot of focus on electric vehicles and what that'll mean for, you know, for end level demand. But nevertheless, you can't really make money as an energy producer selling oil at $42. So eventually there'll be a significant supply response. And we think that the price of crude oil will go back towards $60 or $65, maybe even higher, but not likely to the old highs because of, you know, some of those other conditions that we discussed. When we think about our energy stocks, the majority of our exposure is in the likes of Suncor and Imperial Oil, C&Q, some of the big kind of major companies in Canada. And if we get to $60 oil at some point in the next couple of years, these will be very interesting stocks. They'll be generating free cash flow yields, double-digit free cash flow yields, based on today's share price. The problem is we just don't know exactly when. And the thing that becomes most important in that sector is the balance sheet of the company that you may own in that sector. If the balance sheet's okay, then we're going to get through to the next cycle, no matter when it takes place. If the balance sheet is stretched, then it becomes a bit more of an issue. But, you know, we do think that the big energy companies are kind of interesting for Canadian investors over time. And some of the other names that, you know, I would mention as kind of core holdings in the portfolio would be, you know, our bank, pick your bank at this juncture. You know, not to be biased, but the Royal Bank probably looks kind of interesting relative to its historical trading patterns. People have been concerned over the City National acquisition, not so much the acquisition in itself, but it did use some of the Royal Bank's extra money that they had lying around to pay for it, and they need to build that extra money back up, and as a result, the valuation has been pressured during that period. But, you know, I think over time, you know, I think that looks quite interesting. And Brookfield would be another example of kind of a core holding, a company where, you know, when you go and talk to management, they think about, you know, this is a stock that would be, you know, $33 US today, 44-ish Canadian. They think about how it can be $66 in 5 years' time, and how it can be $130 in 10 years' time, how they can continually compound the capital on your behalf. And that's, you know, that's very central to any investment process. Some of the more beaten up names in Canada that that also look somewhat interesting would be something like potash, which trades at a meaningful discount to what it would cost to replace all their assets. The you know, in this respect, it's almost like they've raised their dividend a number of times, and it's been a bit of a curse, I think, for the company, because when it didn't pay a dividend, it would have never traded this low. But because people are concerned that they may have to cut the dividend, it's pressured the share price, which in our minds presents a very attractive long-term opportunity, because, as I say, you couldn't replace the assets for anywhere near what the price trades for today. Two other mentions would be Canadian Utilities, which has been significantly depressed. Again, a dividend stock with great dividend growth track record. Been depressed because of what's going on in Alberta, but a regulated business with a very interesting combination of dividend plus dividend growth. And a bit more of a high flyer, I suppose, in the context of larger cap Canada, but, you know, something like an SNC-Lavalin, which has gone through, you know, a very tough time in the last 12 months with everything going on from a regulatory standpoint, even factoring in a meaningful fine. When you take into consideration the assets they have between the engineering company, the 407, what have you, we think that that looks quite interesting. And, you know, I'll just throw out one U.S. stock, you know, which we've already discussed, but, you know, something like Microsoft, which has done very well this year, but has around, you know, just it's an interesting perspective to think of in terms of not its share price movement, but its business characteristics, around $3.50 a share of free cash flow. So it's a $53 stock with $3.50 a share of free cash. So it's around a 7% free cash yield. And that free cash grows by 8 to 10% a year. So if I could give you a GIC that had those characteristics, and you could put it in your account and it would have $100 beside it forever, you'd say, oh, that's a great GIC. In this instance, Microsoft share price is going to go up and down, but the characteristics are quite attractive relative to what might be available in fixed income. With that, it'd be great if we could have some questions. Chris mentioned, we'd be here till 5 o'clock, so I think he's going to go get the spa. He's going to arrange spa services for everyone. We could all head upstairs. So.
Thanks very much, Stu. And on behalf of everybody here, I appreciate your coming. So we recognize that many people have day commitments to get on with, and if that's the case, we completely understand. And in the interest of being on schedule, I'll ask the first two questions, and these are kind of the two that we get asked most often, and we'll put it to the two speakers as to who would like to answer them. So the first question that we get asked most often is, so what about the Canadian dollar? Can you make some sort of prediction as to where it's going to go? The second question that we get asked an awful lot is, what about the direction of interest rates? Looks like the U.S. is going to embark upon raising interest rates now, and what's that going to look like in Canada? And then the third question was, what about the price of oil? But it sounds like Stu's already answered that one, so we'll just limit it to the currency and the direction of interest rates.
Well, I'll take the currency, I guess. So when we look at the currency over a long-term trend, the Canadian dollar typically trades in a band of plus or minus 20% of fair value. And they define fair value as purchasing power parity, which basically means if you take Canadian dollars to the U.S. or U.S. dollars to Canada, you should be able to buy the same amount of things with the same amount of currency after you take the exchange rate into account. So right now, fair value for the Canadian dollar is about 85 cents, give or take. We're at 75. We think the risk to the downside would be down to 65, but it probably wouldn't last very long because when you get to be 20% undervalued, which is where you'd be at 65 cents, it tends not to last very long and you get a recovery. The main drivers of the currency, the way we look at it, there's three big things that have driven it, two more so in the last little while. Number one is just general risk aversion, so kind of a correlation with the stock market. But the big two lately have been energy prices and interest rates. So in Canada, interest rates have been driven by energy prices. They cut interest rates this year because of the drop in oil prices. And because of that, the difference between U.S. interest rates and Canadian interest rates came in. So even though Canadian interest rates are higher than U.S. rates, it's that change at the margin that moves the currency. And that's what caused the Canadian dollar to sell off so much. So I think to see a recovery in the Canadian dollar, you'd have to see either the U.S. Federal Reserve not hike interest rates or not hike as much as the market currently expects, or the Canadian Central Bank to start raising interest rates, or at least an expectation they'll start raising interest rates. And to get that, I think you'd have to see a pretty big recovery in the oil market. So I think the risk to the Canadian dollar is probably still to the downside if the Fed starts raising rates and Canada doesn't. But to see it pick up, you'd have to see a change in the energy market and a change in the expectations for Canadian interest rates.
Well, interest rates, I think forever we've thought interest rates are going to go higher. In this instance, I think we're finally getting to the point where we're going to get movement from the U.S. Federal Reserve, and likely 12 or 18 months later, we're going to get movement from the Bank of Canada. I think, the one thing that is interesting is interest rates could be, 100 to 200 basis points higher, or 1 or 2% higher, but anything beyond that likely then becomes a headwind for the economy. So it doesn't really get, we don't get this big, spiking higher interest rates. I was at a panel earlier this week on condos in Toronto, which, is a significant, source of debate. And, when you look into, the math behind buying a condominium and renting it and what type of returns you might make, it becomes extremely sensitive to 1 or 2% higher interest rates and really kind of would significantly dent any activity on that front. So I do think interest rates will head higher, but I don't think they're going to head meaningfully higher over the next couple of years.
So with that, I think we've got time for a couple of questions, and if you don't feel like putting your hand up in front of the crowd, we'll be around afterwards and we'd be delighted to engage. So we have one just over here. We purposely told the panelists here that they weren't allowed to address politics or religion. So, however, if anybody wants to take a shot at the new politics...
I'll keep it to the really high level. I think despite what we might think about the changes in tax policy, as far as the economy is concerned, the fact that they're willing to go into deficit and engage in some deficit spending is probably a net positive to the economy. Does that outdo any changes in tax policy? Probably does, because you have to think that the people who are going to receive lower taxes are probably more likely to spend it than the people that are seeing higher taxes. So I think the deficit spending and the higher amount of income going towards families is probably a net positive, but I don't think it'll be all that significant. I think the bigger risk would have been if you had had them coming in, say the NDP coming in and rising corporate tax rates. That would have been a big problem. That's what you're seeing in Alberta, right? You're seeing higher taxes across the board. That's an issue. But on the federal level, I think it's probably a small net positive, just given the higher government spending, which has been lacking for the last few years.
I would totally agree. Like when you look at our, you know, the main drivers of the economy, you know, between housing and energy, you know, housing kind of at best would likely slow and not be the driver that it was. Energy is a bit of a question mark. Even if crude recovered, you probably wouldn't see a host of new projects. So with interest rates low, I think it's a great time for, you know, targeted infrastructure. You know, the question is how do you define that infrastructure program and ensure that it stops at the end? Those would be, you know, some of the longer term considerations.
Any other questions in the group? Well, we will certainly be around afterwards, and I guess it's at this point in time that on behalf of all of us at RBC Dominion Securities and the Harbour Group, we'd like to thank you for attending today. It's really our great pleasure to host you, and we know that without you, our clients, we wouldn't have a business, and we think about that each and every day. So thank you again for coming. We look forward to having you again next year. Season's greetings.